ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In December 2019, Stephanie Brout, along with her mum, her dad and her sister, flew up from Melbourne to Sydney, where the four of them boarded one of those supermassive cruise ships called the Ovation of the Seas that was going to take the family around the South Pacific. One of the day trips the cruise was offering when they got to New Zealand was the chance to visit a live volcano on an island named Waikaari, or White Island. This is New Zealand's most active volcano. But the Browett family didn't know that. They weren't told. Nor did they know that the day before the ship had left Sydney Harbour, the New Zealand authorities had issued an alert that White Island was now entering a phase where an eruption was more likely than normal. And so on the 9th of December, Stephanie, her dad Paul and her sister Crystal joined a group of day trippers who set out for White Island. And they went about exploring its weird grey and brown lunar landscape that was splashed with yellow and green. Then at 2:11 p.m., as they were walking away from the steaming crater, the volcano erupted, ejecting a vast amount of steam, gas, and smoke and ash and rocks into the sky and across the whole island. The force of the blast knocked Stephanie off her feet and onto the ground that was now covered in hot ash. Stephanie, who was 23 years old at the time, suffered volcanic burns to 70% of her body. 22 people were killed, and many more were left with lifelong injuries. As Stephanie Browett slowly recovered, she and her mum had to ask the question, how was it that the cruise ship company had decided to put passengers in their care on the most dangerous volcanic island in the world? Stephanie's written a memoir with her mum, Marie, that's called Out of the Ashes. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here.
Like I said, on that day, 2019, on December the 4th, your family sailed out of Sydney on the Ovation of the Seas. I've been on one of those giant things. They're like kind of floating skyscrapers. And this was you, your mum, your sister Crystal, your dad. Mm-hmm. How close-knit were you as a family?
Oh, we were very close. We did everything together. And I mean, it got to a point where if it was coming up to my birthday or some sort of an event or celebration, it was always like, what are we doing, us four? Not me and my friends, not other people. I always valued and appreciated my time and genuinely enjoyed every single moment I had with us four.
Now, your mum, Marie, has MS, so I suppose a cruise like that would actually be really great for her. It's a great way for someone with MS to see the world, isn't it?
Well, that's right. Once we reached a certain age where my parents knew, okay, we can actually take in and enjoy and remember these holidays, these moments shared together, we realised that a cruise would be a better option because of my mum's progression with her MS, her multiple sclerosis. Cruises were something we started doing a few years beforehand, which we found quite good because obviously everything's all on board. You don't really have to worry about too much except for what you might do on the day that you're stopped at a port.
Now, your mum had a real manager and has a managerial role in the family. What role did your dad tend to play on these cruises?
My dad brought the jokes and the laughter and the banter with all of us. You know, if there was anything serious, my dad would manage to, you know, tone it down a bit and have us laugh at ourselves and just bring some light.
Your dad was a Carlton supporter, whereas you, your sister Crystal and your mum were Collingwood supporters, and yet you were able to share a house together. How is that even possible? Has that ever been done before? How could that possibly happen, Stephanie?
Yes. I mean, I know I've heard stories from my mum telling me how Dad was very invested in turning us into Carlton supporters from the day we were born. He bought us bibs. We had all the Carlton gear possible that you could. And my mum told me she has this very vivid memory of the moment she pulled one of the Carlton bibs off of us, threw it to the ground and stood on it. And my dad apparently took it very personal. But unfortunately, it still didn't work. We ended up following our mum.
So you're on the cruise. When did you become aware of the existence of White Island and the possibility of visiting it?
whilst we were on board the cruise ship, so we hadn't seen anything about it or heard of it beforehand at all.
Now, if I'd seen like a brochure saying, come and visit a live volcano, I would have been an absolute hard yes to that. I mean, who wouldn't want to see a live volcano? Was that you? Were you super keen?
Well, the way it was shared, it didn't make it sound like anything to be scared of or anything that we should be worried about. It was just put on this page in this brochure, mixed among every single other tour that was available for all of the stops in New Zealand that we were having. And it said nothing except, you know, wear some comfortable shoes. And then all we knew was that if you couldn't handle a bit of walking, some trekking, maybe it's not the right choice for you. So that was one of the reasons my mum was like, okay, maybe not for me.
So when the ship docked on the North Island of New Zealand, you, your sister Crystal and your dad, Paul, took the trip out there. What was the journey out to White Island like?
The journey was much longer than we had anticipated because the brochure actually said the duration of the tour and we knew it would be a long duration. However, what we didn't know was that more than half of that time would be spent getting to and from the island itself, involving a bus, getting us to the regional area of Whakatane, and then a jet boat ride that would get us to the rest of the way to the island out in the ocean, which was quite a bit of a distance.
What safety equipment were you given?
Once we were on the jet boat and only once we were pretty close to the island itself, were we provided a face mask, a gas mask. It's not one of the ones you would see in a TV or a film or anything like that. It does not go over the entirety of your head. It literally just goes and covers your nose and your mouth. So just the bottom half of your face to sort of help make breathing a little bit easier is what I understood. And then a hard hat as well, which was to be worn for the entirety of our trek on the island itself, just in case any issues with maybe like a falling rock or something happened.
So then you all piled into a rubber Zodiac, an inflatable raft. And what did the island look like as you approached it?
Desolate, very empty. I assumed it would be pretty flat, you know, just like a beach. You can walk into the ocean and walk back up onto land, but that's not what it was at all. By the time our raft had arrived at the edge of the island, there was then another rusty ladder that we'd have to climb up of to get onto the land. I know my dad, he made sure me and my sister went up before him so that he could keep the ladder as still as possible for us and make sure we weren't rocking. And then Dad followed suit.
So what instructions were you given by your guides once you got onto the island itself?
Before we were on the island, the only instruction was to have our hard helmets on at all times and then wear the mask that we were provided just as needed, really. But then once we were on the island, that's when they started to go through some more instructions, which included walking in a straight file in one straight line and making sure that we were behind one of the guides at all times and also that we would have a guide at the back of the line as well to make sure we were right in between and no one would get lost. They wanted us to follow them in a straight file and stick to a certain path because apparently you could fall through some holes in the ground because the land wasn't very safe in all areas. So they had a path they wanted us to stick to for that reason. They were also mentioned the possibility of boulders falling from the sides of the wall because what people don't realise is with this volcano itself, and I didn't realise until later on, is that you're basically heading inwards into an amphitheatre-shaped island. It's not cone-shaped in that sense. So you're surrounded by walls all around you.
And at this point, were you looking at your dad and your sister going, what's going on here at this point?
Yeah, I was because these were things I would have assumed we'd been told beforehand, not once you were already there. Because once you were already there, it didn't feel like that we could turn back around. You know, it felt like, okay, we're here now. The raft had been taken back to the jet boat, so it felt like we were stuck there. And then we're hearing all this information and it's like, okay, this is starting to sound a bit more serious than we anticipated, than what was written down in this brochure we were given by Royal Caribbean.
And when one of the guides mentioned that the eruption warning had been lifted to level 2, with level 3 being an eruption, what did you all think then?
Yeah, I was confused because the way it was said, it was just, we've moved up to a level two now, and for that reason, we're going to be doing things a little bit quicker than usual. And then it was straight on to the next point, and I'm just like, I don't know what a level two is. No one's gone through the levels with us, so I'm not sure how to take that. But then the sentence afterwards, which was, you know, we're going to be doing this a little bit quicker than usual, well, that's obviously got me thinking, you know, well, why? What does that mean? That doesn't sound very good to hear that. But, you know, by then we're already moving on to the next piece of information, so my mind's just trying to keep up with everything.
So then you approached the crater lake. What did you see as you approached this huge lake in the crater of the volcano?
There was just this huge edge of where the land just stopped. So I remember seeing that and thinking, wow, this is just so much bigger than I anticipated. And I had no idea of what to expect. So it's just this huge edge, really far, from side to side, right in between the walls that we were surrounded by. And then it felt like if you got too close to the edge, you could very much easily fall over. But I was also scared of the edge just falling beneath my feet. So I made sure to keep a distance. I mean, we were told to stay behind a certain area anyway, but I thought to myself, it'll be better to probably stay a bit further back than what they've even said. But straight away, you're seeing all this, like, clear clouds is what I would call it, that cover this lake. So we didn't actually get to see the lake because it was just covered in these clear clouds, which I know now is obviously the steam that was rising from the heat of the lake itself. And it would slowly rise up, just slowly, ever so slowly. And it was just very peaceful. It wasn't loud. It was very quiet. It didn't look scary. You couldn't tell what you were looking at, so it didn't look scary. It just looked very fluffy, like a cloud.
So you and your dad and your sister were walking away to get back to the boat to leave the island. What do you remember of those minutes that followed?
We had just turned around from the crater and we were about a minute or two into our walk, knowing that we were heading back now. We're basically done. We've come and seen the main part of this volcanic island. And I know my sister is behind myself and dad. So me and my dad were a few feet ahead of my sister. So every so often we would turn around just to make sure she was keeping up with us, but not really concerned because we knew there were a few other people and a tour guide at the end anyway. But she was focused on taking some photos and some last-minute footage. And it was only one of those last moments that we had turned around where we then began to notice some black smoke rising from the crater. And it didn't look very big and it didn't look like it was moving outwards. It just looked like black smoke coming out and rising upwards.
And were you more kind of fascinated than frightened at this point?
Yeah, I was fascinated because I was just like, what's happening right now? I just wasn't sure what was happening. And I thought, okay, maybe someone's about to explain what's going on. And then my dad's just telling us, oh, look, take a photo. He's pointing it to my sister because she hadn't turned that way just yet. Look, take a photo. So, we had no idea of the danger that was about to unfold.
And then what happened?
Within a few seconds, we hear this word, run, really urgently as well. And then that's the moment where I felt like, shit, is this an eruption? There has to be an eruption. Shit, run. I remember turning around and I could hear my dad repeating the words to me and my sister, run. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, crap. I can't believe we're about to be caught in a volcanic eruption. What is this? This can't be real. And then my main focus was just don't fall. Please don't fall over. I'm looking down at my feet, trying to make sure that I don't trip, that I'm sticking to this apparent path that we're meant to be sticking to. I was very conscious of this path that we're meant to be focused on because I didn't want to fall through. And just thinking to myself, okay, just keep running forward, And thinking, okay, hopefully Dad and my sister are behind me because I was too scared to look back because I didn't want to fall.
And what could you hear behind you?
Yeah, so that's when the silence was not so silent anymore because the volcano was starting to make such a loud grumbling noise, but it was following us. You could tell it was getting louder and louder by the second. It was very much like a moving aeroplane or a moving train that was right on top of you and could hit you at any moment. And then on top of that, I could hear the noises of people. Just, I couldn't make out what was being said, but I could hear panic and confusion among everyone as I was running.
You know, I think we've seen this kind of scene more than a few times in Hollywood movies. Is it anything like that? Or what is the reality of running away from a massive volcano as it's erupting and starting to eject this massive amount of gas and steam and rock and ash into the air?
I mean, my knowledge of volcanoes was not very good at the time. It was only what I had seen or had heard of through some movies in the past. So I was thinking we were going to be caught in some lava at some point, and that we were definitely going to die if that was the case, if this lava had caught up to us. So that was my main focus, was to just survive, just get off of this place. I had no idea about how fast this thing could travel. It was just, we need to get off. That was my only train of thought, and just hoping and praying that my dad and my sister were keeping up. I couldn't tell if they were next to me or behind me, but I knew that was somewhere right near me.
Volcanoes in these moments eject what they call shrapnel, little bits of rock. Were you seeing that starting to spatter around you as this huge rumbling sound was coming up behind you?
Yeah, for myself, I don't remember seeing any of the projectiles that were coming out. And I think that's because I was very much focused on my feet and just looking at the ground. But you could definitely hear it. You could hear things landing around you. So that I knew definitely that there was stuff being thrown in the air.
And what happened when the seismic blast wave of the eruption hit your body?
I was knocked down instantly, just face first straight to the ground, the hard surface ground, mind you, with such a force that it winded me completely, and I could no longer breathe. I felt myself trying to catch my breath. I was that winded. It didn't stop there because I couldn't get myself back up. And I couldn't stop myself from moving. It was knocking and tumbling me and rolling me over everywhere. So I was being thrown around on the ground whilst being burnt at the same time in such horrificness. There's just no words to describe the pain. It's like a stinging pain, but it's all over your body and it just doesn't end. On top of the force of this thing that's just holding you and rolling you around on this ground, that's also cutting you, and you can feel the rocks and the things on the ground stabbing you and cutting you everywhere, on top of all of that hitting you as well. So it's just, I'm going to die here, aren't I? At that moment, I knew I couldn't do anything anymore. I'd lost control of my body, of all my movement. I had to just let what was happening happen. I thought I was going to die. And it's just the unbelievableness of the situation just struck me.
Was there part of you thinking, is this real? Is this really happening?
Yeah, I can't believe this is real. It doesn't feel real that this would be taking place. What are the chances? I couldn't believe we were being caught up in this right now. Just the amount of tours I hear taking place in volcanoes, and you never hear anything like this. I've heard of some take place and people who live nearby being caught up in one, but yeah, just the unbelievableness and the chances of it happening.
How hard was it to pull yourself back up again?
I realised it had stopped once I was no longer being pushed and shoved. My body had just come to a sudden halt on this ground, which was boiling hot because it was encompassed in ash everywhere. I realised, okay, somehow I've survived this blast. I guess now is my moment to try and get out of here. If I'm going to survive, I need to get out of here and get help or get off. So I knew, the first thing I knew was I need to get myself up. I couldn't see anyone else around me. I couldn't hear anyone else around me. Suddenly it had become very quiet as well, except for the ash, I guess, settling around from the air. So I went to push myself up off of the ground with my hands. And that's when I realized I got like a centimeter off the ground, and I just slumped back down because my legs were that jelly-like. They just had no strength left in them at all. And I was like, okay, I can't stay here. I need to go again. So I tried a second time, and I got a bit more distance up from the ground. But again, I fell back down. The strength, it was just not there at all. But I was very persistent and determined because I knew it was my only chance. So I tried again. And thankfully, that third time, because I don't know how much longer I could have kept going, that third time I did finally manage to get myself up through a lot of pain and struggle and very, very slowly. But I was up and standing, and that's when I was like, okay, now I've got to move. I've got to move forward away to where help would be, to where we were dropped off, to where the boat was, because I knew there was the person who had driven the boat, the skipper, was still on that boat, so he would have seen everything that had happened. So I was like, I need to get to a spot where I can be seen.
What did you see when you looked at your hands and arms, Stephanie?
Yeah, there was a moment once I had lost movement and I had fallen over and realised I couldn't get back up, and I just sat with my thoughts, realising, okay, now I'm stuck waiting for help here. I started to take in my surroundings and try to assess my injuries, and I realised I couldn't do so properly because I was covered in black ash, so I couldn't see myself properly. And I still had my clothing on. That, because it was a steam eruption, steam gas eruption, it goes through your clothing. It doesn't burn your clothing. But my hands had nothing on them. So when I looked at my hands, that was when I noticed my nails. I had gotten a colourful manicure before coming on the cruise ship, but I could see hints of my nails just hanging off my fingers, loose skin falling off as well. And that's when I realised, if that's what I'm seeing on my hands, clearly I'm very, very bad everywhere else. This is bad. This is really bad. I don't know what's going to happen from here onwards.
How did you become aware that your dad was still alive at this point?
I tried my best to look for them. Once I had landed in this spot where I ended up being stuck, I was among a group of people. It was the first time I'd properly seen some people around me again from my group. And I scanned and looked to see if that was my dad or my sister, because I was wondering, are they alive still? Are they alive still? I hope they're alive still. But they weren't there. I could not see them. About 15 minutes in or so, I'd say, I heard my name being called. I knew instantly, that's Dad. I could hear my dad's voice, and he was going, Steph, Steph. And I responded, yes, thinking that he'd have a follow-up question. He was needing to know something. But then it went silent. And I just remember thinking, oh, what did he want? What did he need? I wish I knew. I don't know what he was thinking. I wonder how he's doing. And where is my sister? Because he had only screamed my name. And then a while later, he ended up repeating my name, and it was the second time that I realised he was checking in to make sure I was staying awake and conscious.
What happens to your sense of time as you lie there, Steph, in this bizarre situation?
Yeah, very difficult to keep up with time. In my mind, I was holding on to the information that we were told as we were making our way to this island from the tour guides on the jet boat, which was that by boat it takes about 90 minutes to get there, but by helicopter it can take around 20 minutes. So one of the things I was holding on to in my mind is that, okay, I just need to stay conscious for a minimum of 20 minutes at least, maybe 30, give or take, for them to actually know what's happening. 30 minutes. That's one of the pieces of information I really held on to, 30 minutes. I just need to hold on and stay awake for 30 minutes at least.
Sometimes people in these situations have these conflicting voices in their head.
That's
telling
right.
You to let go or demanding you stay alive. Did you have that?
Yeah, I did. I did. I mean, I felt it in my body. My body very much wanted to close off. I could feel my eyes wanting to shut. And in my mind, I could hear myself thinking, it would be just so much easier if I just shut off right now. I wouldn't feel this pain. It could just be done. But then there was another part in my mind, another side saying, don't do that, because if you do, you will not wake up again. And I knew deep down my mum you know, my mum was somewhere on this cruise not knowing what had happened. And this was one of her worst fears, something horrible happening to her family. She was always very protective of us. So I knew this was her worst fear come true. And I couldn't believe it because as kids, me and my sister would always tell her, you have nothing to worry about. What are the chances? Relax a bit. It's okay. So I think in my mind, I was very much battling as well for my mum as much as myself because I knew she wouldn't survive if none of us came back to her.
How do you reflect on those conflicting voices in your head in the years that have passed now, Stephanie?
I think the will to live was just so much stronger than the one to give up. That's how I take it. That voice telling me to not close my eyes and reminding me that if I did, I may not wake up ever again. It was very likely I wouldn't wake up again. I'm very grateful to have had that. Because I know now that's true. I felt it in me. I know now that would have been very much true. So I just think the will to live was that much stronger.
So you were telling me before about how you're lying there very badly burnt, trying to will yourself to stay alive. You can hear your dad's voice in the distance somewhere. And then a helicopter landed nearby. Now, these guys weren't paramedics, but three men named Jason, Mark, and Tom. Tell me about these men, Stephanie.
As soon as I heard the helicopter land nearby, all I could think of was, thank God. Thank God, because I don't know if I could stay here and stay awake any longer. I could tell it had been a long time and much longer than 30 minutes. And then one of the first things I hear is, we're here, we're going to help you guys, we're here. And one of them comes up to me and he says, you're okay, you're going to be okay. We're going to get you off and you're going to be okay, just stay with me. And then they start walking off and going towards other people. And then we're being told help is on the way, but we've got to wait another 20 minutes. And I just thought to myself, wow, okay, that's a long time on top of whatever we've already waited for. I don't know if I can do that.
Now, these guys were not paramedics. Like I said, they had a helicopter service on the mainland and they'd seen the volcano erupt and
That's
they'd
right.
gone out there on their own initiative. They're kind of like Good Samaritans, these guys.
Exactly. I didn't know that at the time. I was thinking they were paramedics. And then once they did end up boarding us on these helicopters and one of them flew myself and my family off, that was the realization, oh, where is the medical equipment? And then later on, once I was awake and in hospital much, much later on, that's when I was told about these three pilots, who they were and how they just worked for regular helicopter companies. One of them had seen it erupt from the mainland and called in some of his workers to help him fly straight out there to help whoever they could, knowing that there were tours taking place. So they are amazing people who just instantly did what they thought was right.
We now know the paramedics had been told not to fly out, that they were going to put themselves at too great a risk to fly out. So they didn't get there for another 2.5 hours after the eruption. Mm-hmm. What do you think about all that now, Stephanie?
I remember on the day of the eruption being told by these regular pilots that we had to hold on for another 20 minutes because rescue was on the way. So what upsets me is that there was conflicting information. They were being told that these actual rescue companies were going to go there. And then at some point they changed their minds because it was considered too dangerous. Those pilots could have taken us off that island sooner instead of keeping us there waiting in that ash, breathing in that noxious gases, stuck in the sun, being burnt over and over on top of our injuries. Every second counts in an emergency like this.
So they flew you to the hospital, the local hospital, and put you in a medically induced coma. What are the last things you remember before slipping into a coma? Do you have any memory of that at all?
Yeah, I do. I feel like I remember everything, weirdly enough. So I remember arriving at the hospital and straight away being taken inside and hearing just a ruckus of noise, just panic and screaming. So I knew I was among other people that had been burnt from this eruption. And I had this team of people around me shouting orders, doing things. I could feel liquid on my body, which I could only assume was to get rid of the ash that was covering me. And then in that moment, I heard my dad. I believe he was right next to me. And I could hear him speaking to a staff member and giving them his name, my name, my sister's name, and then telling them my mum's name. And then I remember from that point forward, they put an intravenous strip in me and they knocked me out and put me into a coma.
You had kind of really unusual burns. These aren't just heat burns. You were drenched in sulfuric acid. You had more than 20 operations. Eventually, you lost 8 of your fingers. When you came out of the coma, what state were you in?
I was very much delirious. It wasn't an instant thing where I just woke up straight away from my coma. It was a very slow process. There were a lot of nightmares that took place of just ending up in this weird room that I did not recognise, surrounded by people. And some I knew, some I could recognise their faces, but then there were other people who I had no idea who they were. And it looked like it was a birthday party. There was a cake, there were some decorations, and I had no idea who it was for. But my family was there as well. I could see my dad and my sister and my mum. And then there's this noise coming from outside this room. And everyone starts hiding. I start hiding. We're all really scared. And then my dad goes to open this door and telling him not to. And he opens this door and instantly there's these men, masked intruders, trying to come inside and attack us. And then he goes out there to stop them. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, Dad, come back, come back. You're going to get hurt. Don't do that. Come back. And then all of a sudden they push him over a railing and that's it. He's gone. That nightmare really sticks with me just because of the circumstances later on with Dad.
Was it more like a hallucination than a nightmare? I mean, did it feel very real at the time?
It felt very real. It felt like I was in it. I was living it right there in that moment. And that's what made it worse, because that fear and that terror of seeing him being thrown off this railing, it felt very real, like I had just lost my dad. When I had finally fully awoken from my coma and was lucid, was present with everyone around me, I was confused as to where I was exactly. And I couldn't speak properly because I had things in my throat, machines all around me. I remember trying to just find out, where am I? And then they told me I'm in a hospital back home in Melbourne, because I had no clue where I was, what country anymore. And then instantly just Dad and Crystal, where's my sister and where's my dad? And my mum was the first person there in the room and she was telling me, your sister's okay and she's at another hospital and your dad's here as well and he's in the room next to you and they're okay.
That wasn't quite true, was it?
No, it wasn't. But with the way I was medically, with my severe injuries and the drugs I was on and the surgeries I was having, I was very much in and out of consciousness. I didn't question it. I took it as truth. And when I was told finally that my sister had actually passed and she had passed away on the day of the eruption, she never made it back home to Melbourne. She never made it to a hospital. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it because I was told otherwise. Of course, I was hurt because after all this time, I thought we're injured, we're hurt, but we're all here. And that's what mattered to me most, is that we were all here back home with Mum and that we'd be okay in some sense. And then I was being told that's not true. But then what really struck me was how naive and stupid I felt, which I know I wasn't, but in that moment, that's how I felt. I just felt really stupid for not realising this sooner.
Stephanie, you're right that you were not just feeling shattered and depressed, you were also feeling guilty. But you'd made a superhuman effort to get on your feet on that island to go looking for your sister. Why were you feeling guilty?
She's my younger sister, and as an older sister, you just feel this role of being their protector, having to protect her and look after her for the rest of her life and be there for her all the time and help her get through anything. And it just felt like I was such a letdown that I had failed in my duty to protect her in our worst moment. That kills me, and I will always feel guilty for that, for not even just being present so that she knew she could have at least been around her family.
That's been so unfair on yourself. Yeah. That's really been incredibly unfair on yourself. Did anyone tell you that?
Well, yeah, and I mean, logically, I know as well in my mind that that's unfair and it's not realistic at all. Like, the situation was the situation we were in and it was an impossible one to be in and I couldn't control everything that was happening around me. But, you know, your body and the way you feel on the inside is just a whole other story, and it's very hard to tell your body how to feel.
And then more bad news. You were told your father was slipping away. He had been evacuated into hospital, but he was just slipping away. Was it possible for you to speak to your dad before he died?
It was very difficult because of the way we both were with our injuries and bedridden and bedbound. And then he was surrounded by machines and I couldn't really get up or out of my bed much. So it was very hard to sort of put us together in the same area. But then when I was told that they thought it was time and that he wasn't going to make it and survive his injuries, I couldn't believe it because so much time had gone by. It was a month. So at that point, the chance of him dying, that didn't cross my mind at all. I thought we had passed that point. I didn't think it was a possibility. And then having to say my goodbyes to him and just come to terms with the fact that half of us is now gone, that's half of our family has been torn away from us. And then with my dad, I don't get to hold him properly because of the way I'm bandaged up and the way I'm stuck in my bed and then the way he's in his bed. It felt very cruel and unfair. And then having my mum by my side at the same time saying her goodbyes and just seeing her break down, the whole thing was just overwhelming in every way possible and imaginable.
At the same time, you're going through this series of very, very painful skin graft operations. And there was a moment when you were finally allowed to look at yourself in a mirror and you would have looked very different. What was that like for you to see someone you didn't fully recognise in the mirror?
Yeah, I had no idea what to expect because I hadn't seen any of my injuries because I was constantly covered in dressing changes and bandages and wraps. So when I was given the chance to finally see my face, I took it thinking so much time had passed that I was progressing and that surely it can't be that bad. But then when I saw my face in the mirror for the first time, I couldn't recognise myself. I was still so bloated. My face just was very, very fat and full of liquid. It was very splotchy. I had red patches here, red patches there. I could not recognise myself and I felt quite disgusting looking at myself. I just felt like horrible to be seen.
So how do you get from there to resolving to survive and to thrive? What thoughts do you arrive at that take you to that place?
I mean, my recovery was definitely not linear, was not straight by any means. It was very much up and down and I relied on other people heavily. But my mum was constantly by my side and she always reminded me, you've got to do this for your family. You've got to do this for us. It's not just for yourself. It's for your dad and your sister. They would not want to see you like this, giving up. They would want you to have a fulfilled life, to do everything you want to do, to get out of here. I mean, that resonated with me because I know my family, I know my dad and my sister, and I know what she was saying was very true. I think it was deep down inside me, I just realised I couldn't give up, no matter what. I'm never one to let people down. I've always been a bit of a people pleaser and just, you know, helping or doing whatever was needed of me in life. And I had fought so hard on that island to survive and to make it back to my mum because I knew she was on her own, that even though there were moments where I was thinking about giving up, I think deep down I knew that could never happen. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that to myself. I couldn't do that to mum or my dad and my sister.
After more than 3 months in hospital, you were allowed to leave to go into rehab. And you got this grand farewell from the staff at the hospital. You must have really formed quite a profoundly lovely relationship with the nurses there, Stephanie.
Yeah, I remember a few of them were quite teary as well, saying their goodbyes to me, which was, it just meant the world to me to see the relationship we had. But also it was scary because I had come to rely on these people for so much. And then I was being taken to a new place where I had to meet new people, start up a new relationships, I guess, in a way, but not knowing what to expect.
During rehab, they made you one of those compression suits they give to burns victims. You had one that covered your head a bit like a wrestler's mask. And then you did this really great thing, which was to reach out to another burns survivor, Turia Pitt. Turia's been on Conversations. She came on a few years ago. How did Turia respond?
I was down in the slumps at that point because I think the transition had really kicked me down. I'm being told all this information about how things are going to be okay, that this isn't going to be forever, my skin's going to keep improving. It's very hard to believe when it's coming from people who haven't had that happen to them, I guess. So I thought I would reach out to Turia Pitt. She's very well known in Australia and I admired her before all of this had happened anyway. And I thought, I don't know many other people with severe burns, but I can reach out to her, see if she can help me and just give me an inkling as to how I'm going to progress. What is my future going to look like? I just need to hear something from someone who has also gone through this. And she responded. And I just remember feeling very ecstatic to see that she had seen and cared enough to respond, because I thought, who am I? Like, I'm just nobody. She probably gets these messages all the time. But to see that she responded and she put in so much thought and effort into her response, into answering every single one of my questions that I had given her, but then also offering to have a chat with me on the phone and speak with me and just answer any other questions that I had, that meant such a great deal to me. And I was able to see her. We did it on a video chat. So seeing her and how she was doing in her everyday life. You know, she's got her own family now and she had just had another child. And just seeing how well she was doing in life, that really boosted my spirits.
Yeah, you can be told all these things, can't you? But you actually saw her doing what people promised you could happen to you at the far end of your recovery. But you actually saw her living that life.
Exactly. And that meant so much to me. And so she offered to send one of her friends that also had severe burns from the same bushfire. And so she sent her friend Kate Sanderson to visit me at the hospital. And this was just an extra, extra large oomph that I needed after speaking to Terry Pitt, because now I was seeing someone right in front of me in person. She had come on her own. She was independent. She was walking and moving fine. I could hardly see any of her burns from her skin grafts. She looked amazing, beautiful, normal. And it really drove into me that, okay, my skin does have a while to heal. It actually is quite early on. And she told me that. It does take a few years. Your skin has to settle down. So much will keep changing and changing onwards. But she was working. She was living her own life independently, living on her own, doing everything, volunteering. She was just normal and doing whatever she wanted to do, with nothing stopping her. And I had to hear that and see that for me to understand that my future is just as open as I thought it was beforehand, before I was injured.
One of the things that can come out of a catastrophe like that is you can find a whole other way of looking at the world and a whole other way of seeing things that other people wouldn't see. So you went on TikTok and did the most un-TikTok thing in the world. TikTok, which is full of videos of my perfect life in Byron with my lovely husband and my beautiful house and my perfect children and my plastic surgery face. You started showing images of your skin on your back on TikTok as it was slowly beginning to heal.
Mm-hmm.
What was the response like once you posted that stuff?
I felt like at that point I had begun to build a nice community of followers. The people that were supporting me and following me were very kind, but I don't think they fully understood just how much they were impacting my recovery. So there was a point where I thought, okay, one of my worst areas I feel, and still to this day, is my back. The injuries on my back were very severe. I obviously took the full force of the pyroclastic density flow in my back as I was running and when I got hit. And you can see that. It dug through several layers of my skin, my epidermis, to practically right down to the muscle and the fat. It's a very deep crevice on my back. So that was one of the areas I hated. And just watching the recovery, I felt like it's not going to get anywhere. But then I built this following and this support, and I felt like there was a point where I've got to be open. I'm sharing some other areas of my body. I think it's time I can share some progress photos of my back. And I did that, and I put in a lot of thought about the message that I would write to go along with those photos, about how scary and daunting it was to be doing this. But the response was really nice. It was overwhelmingly nice and kind. And people were just shocked to see the difference that a couple of months could make. And hearing that, I was like, you know what, they're right. That is a big difference. That's a big change. And I still have so much time to go. I should be proud of my skin and how it's progressing. So that, I think it just allowed me to realize that I was in safe hands.
I think a lot of people who've been listening will be wondering all along, what on earth was that cruise ship company doing when it told you, your dad and your sister and everyone else who went on the trip that it would be a tremendous idea to take you all out to one of the most dangerous islands in the world that had just had its alert level raised to a level 2 with the threat of an eruption? What on earth were they thinking? I know that thought occurred to both you and your mum as well. And so you pursued the company through the courts in Miami, where Royal Caribbean, the ship company, was based. Mm-hmm. Now, they tried to argue that no one could have foreseen such an event. But your lawyers had managed to retrieve evidence from your sister's phone, which had been found on the island. Tell me what was on the phone and why that didn't work out so well for the company.
My sister was unintentionally filming some background conversations. And one of the conversations she caught was from another lady of our group speaking to one of the tour guides. And I guess she wanted to ask what a level two meant, because we weren't told what those levels meant. So this guide was telling her that it meant that we were one level below being at an eruption. So level two is just about to erupt and level three is an eruption. So we were right on the cusp. And then the tour guide came out and said that we were practically nearing a level three now. That was a huge piece of information, of evidence that my sister had accidentally caught on her phone, and one that they tried hard to not have kept in our case.
Despite your condition and your mum's MS, the company insisted that you come out all the way out to Miami to be medically inspected there. But in the end, on the very eve of the scheduled trial, they agreed to settle with you. Why do you think they were so quick to settle with you just before the evidence of all this was put to a jury, Steph?
I think it was just having to face the jury. Once you begin, there's no going back. And I think that was something they didn't want to do, because they knew it wasn't going to look good no matter what.
60 Minutes did a very sympathetic report on how you've survived throughout of all of this, and they filmed you taking off the pressure mask that you've been wearing all that time. How did you prepare for that moment on 60 Minutes?
I feel like there was never enough preparation I could do to be ready for that moment. I knew I wanted to do it with 60 Minutes. I felt very safe and comfortable with them after the first time I had worked with Sarah Arbo. She was very incredibly kind and lovely, and I felt very safe with her. So I thought it'd be nice once that moment came 2 years later to take my mask off, to be able to share it on a public format, thinking that it would be nice for other people to see, because maybe they can gain some inspiration themselves with something that they're struggling to get through. Because I knew how much it meant to me to be able to see someone like Tyria Pitt sharing her own life and things she had accomplished online. And then in that moment, when it came to the day where I did have to unmask, Sarah was incredibly kind. I had gotten to know some of the sound and microphone crew as well at that point, and I think I could tell they were doing their best to make me feel as comfortable as possible as well. They were incredibly kind, same with the producer.
There was that lovely moment when Sarah Arbo said to you, after you took your compression head mask off, she just said, "Oh, Steph, you're beautiful." How did that feel for you?
It wasn't just the words. I could see it in her face. She looked very proud and happy for me. And so in the moment, I could feel it, and I wasn't sure what to say back. You know, it was just so nice to hear, and I didn't have the words of what to say back. But from that moment onwards, I was like, okay, I think this will be okay. She made me feel okay.
On the anniversary, you went back to New Zealand for a commemorative service, which was very, very moving, and you got to meet those men with the helicopter who'd rescued you and your dad. How did that commemorative service make you feel going through that, particularly the one with the local Maori people?
For one of the services, all of the families were able to print off photos of their loved ones who had passed away. So for myself, I was holding a photo of my dad, and then my mum was holding a photo of my sister. We were able to hold on to a photo of our loved ones as we walked inside towards their spiritual home, their spiritual house, for the Maori community, and then place those photos down at the very front of the building so that you could see everyone's faces, all of those who had passed. And then we were sat side to side and then brought inside their spiritual home where they continued the service. It was really nice to be a part of that, but then also the impact that this eruption had. Some people that passed away were also from there as well. So I think we felt very together in that moment, just all of the families. We were just present in that moment, mourning what had happened, but also being welcomed as though we were also a part of this community. We felt very taken in by these people.
I get this feeling, despite the strangeness and the trauma of everything that's happened to you, there's a deep sanity within you, Stephanie. And I wonder mm-hmm. if you think you were always like that or if you're different now. Are you different under the skin?
I think I've always been like that. I think that's just who I am deep down inside. I find it very hard to be a hard person to be around. I like to be a good person to be around. I want people to enjoy my presence. I want to be the best version of myself. I want to be respected. I want to be loved. And I want to do that for other people as well. You know, there were a lot of moments where I had anger built up inside of me, a lot of sadness, all because of the grief that I was going through and still go through. But I just don't feel like I can put that on other people. I just don't feel like it would be right. But in saying that, I feel like I am definitely a much stronger and tougher person than I was. That has definitely amplified inside of me. I mean, if there was a tough person in my family, I would say it was my sister. She was very strong-willed. She always knew what she wanted to do in life, and she worked very hard, and she didn't care about what anyone else thought. And I think I've come to realize that I also need to be like that in ways. Because I've gone through this, I can get through anything else. I'm not going to let anything stop me anymore, or I'm not going to let people hurt me or stay in my life that don't deserve to be. I've come to realize that my time is very precious and I've got to make the most of the time that I do have. So you should value your time, the people around you, your loved ones, your family, your friends, and make the most of it.
Stephanie, it's been completely amazing speaking with you, and thank you for giving us an hour off that time.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Stephanie Brout's book that she's co-written with her mum Marie is called Out of the Ashes. Today's conversation with Stephanie Brout was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Mickey Morris. Executive producer is Eliza Kirsch. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.